First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree discusses news out of Washington. Congresswoman Shelley Pingree is home in Maine this week, which is spring break for Congress, and she is stopping into our studio to answer your questions about this congressional session. Last week, Pingree introduced legislation to help military service members who have been sexually harassed online. She also spoke out about the decision to launch airstrikes on a Syrian airfield. Pingree believes the president needs to consult Congress before taking further action. And yesterday, her focus was on expanding broadband internet in rural Maine. Just check out her Twitter account for more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. We'll ask her about health care, the president's budget, and the prospects for less partisanship. What do you want to ask her? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. These are, to put it mildly, interesting times in our nation's capital. Plans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act fizzled out. A proposed budget calls for some drastic cuts to popular programs, and the partisan divide between Democrats and Republicans appears greater than ever. Joining me in the studio today to talk about the latest news from Washington is Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. She was first elected to represent Maine's 1st Congressional District in 2008. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Congresswoman Pingree? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, Representative Pingree, back to Maine Calling. As I was reading that script, it occurred to me, 2000, next year, a decade in Congress.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking. Time passes very, very quickly, but it's been an honor. And as you said, we live in interesting times, which I think is also like a Chinese curse or something. It's complex.
I wanted to start with sort of a broad question about your role today, serving as a progressive Democrat in a conservative Congress with a Republican president. How do you view your role? Are you aiming to find discrete bills that I can get bipartisan support on and get them passed? Or do you view yourself as the loyal opposition fighting the good fight? Or have you even kind of, are you still working it out?
I think I have always, in the last 8 years, and remember, Republicans have controlled the House for six of those years, I have always looked for ways that I can work on both sides of the aisle to move things forward. And I've been fortunate enough to serve on committees like agriculture, which tend to be more about the region of the country that you're from. You know, are you supporting corn and cotton, or are you for diversified small farms? You know, so there are places you can find middle ground that are very bipartisan. Same with veterans issues. I mean, there's a whole host of things that, frankly, Congress always works very well across the aisle. Now, we're in really unusual times, and we probably see the differences more than we ever did before. But this administration, this moment in time, has yet to play itself out, and we may find, again, places where we can work together on issues. All that said, I'm not sure I'd call myself the loyal opposition, but I do feel that people are so unnerved by the times that we're in and some of the activities of this administration. I do think it's important to be a constant vote for what you believe is right, speaking up to say what you think is the truth. And I think constituents on both sides of the aisle are contacting us, you know, sort of not just one particular group, you know, liberals or progressives. We're hearing from everybody who's saying, wait a minute, I'm not so sure about that health care bill, or wait a minute, you know, what are we going to do in North Korea? So it's a different time, and I don't think it's your normal kind of partisan divide.
You serve on the Appropriations Committee. The president has brought forward a budget that, without even asking you this, I'm going to assume that you are not too happy with. What happens now?
Well, to call this administration in somewhat of a state of chaos is putting it mildly. It's unlike anything that I think I or even my Republican colleagues have seen before. We got what they called a skinny budget about a month ago that gave us some of the suggestion of what was going to be in their full budget, and we're likely to see their full budget sometime in May. It is the worst looking budget I have ever seen, and I don't know how they're attempting to you know, push it forward, move it forward, pull it all together. And I'm not alone in that. Again, I'd say a lot of Republicans have spoken out immediately about things like cuts to foreign aid, cuts to things like LIHEAP, heating assistance in our state, community development block grants, very critical to small communities in the state of Maine, EDA, economic development funds in our state. I mean, just one thing after another, Tiger grants. I mean, we wouldn't have rebuilt the Sarah Long Bridge without a Tiger grant. We wouldn't be improving the Port of Portland. I mean, these things are fundamental no matter where you are politically. And they're just, you know, slash zero, zero, zero in places you're shaking your head saying, like, what's their plan here? What's the, you know, opportunity or, you know, what's moving, going to move forward on this? So when I say state of chaos, it's because it's hard for us to understand the rhyme or reason behind it. They're very slow in getting to us, you know, actual information of what's going to do. And as you've seen, they're not really coherent yet on what their plan is. So we're standing by. And I think, again, we'll have a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who want to bring some sense back into the budget. And in May, you know, really debate what we're going to do moving forward.
Okay, so really, no way to know this year. The uncharted territory.
Uncharted territory. And again, I'm not saying that as a partisan, because I just want to say there's so many Republicans who feel the same way. This is an unusual administration, and there are many things people like about the idea of the, you know, shake it up. They're not going to do it in the traditional way. But it comes with this sense of, you know, destabilizing, you know, sort of lack of any kind of you know, big plan moving forward and leaving all of us a little bit in the dark about what they're really thinking.
Last month when you were home in Maine, you held a town hall meeting about health care. And at the time, there hadn't been a vote yet on the proposed Republican plan. We know what has happened since then. But I want to ask you what now. Even people who support the Affordable Care Act acknowledge that it has problems. You have acknowledged that it has problems. What are the chances of Congress going in and fixing some of those?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think because their kind of hastily thrown together bill failed, or they failed to believe there were sufficient votes, so they didn't take it up. I like to think there's a better opportunity than we've ever had to go back to the drawing board and say, which the president has said, he hasn't acted on it, but he said, well, I'm just going to go after Democratic votes, and I'll find a way to have a plan that meets both sides. Look, we'd be very happy to go back and work on the issues that are there in the Affordable Care Act. And again, he's mentioned things, you know, bringing down the cost of prescription drugs, negotiating for better prices, a lot of things we could be doing that would help control costs, get more competition into the market. There's plenty that could be done. And if they can't find a plan that they can get through with Republican support, perhaps they could go back and do it. But it's a total unknown at this point.
Well, the president, he has said he's going to reach for Democratic votes, but he has also said that the ACA is going to implode. And if you go in and you try to fix it, it's less likely to implode, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, they're in a little bit of a messaging conundrum. They can do things, you know, through the executive branch to make things worse with the Affordable Care Act. But then, you know, it's on their watch. At some point, you know, they now have the administration. They run the Department of Health and Human Services, and they can do things to make it much better. And certainly they could work with us. So I'm trying to stay optimistic at this moment in time and hope that they will do that because, you know, this represents an enormous part of our economy. It's one of people's biggest concerns. How will I afford the cost of health care moving forward? And as everybody in America saw, when the Republicans put the plan on the table that they had kind of put together, it was not palatable, particularly for people in the age group of 50 to 64. It wasn't palatable for hospitals, doctors, and it would have had a huge detrimental impact on our state.
Just last week, you introduced a bill that would help people who have in the military who've been sexually harassed online. This follows the news reports of women having pictures shared online and viewed by hundreds, if not thousands, of other service members. Tell me about that bill and tell me whether you're optimistic that this will pass.
Well, I've been working on this issue and related issues really for several years in Congress. And again, there's quite a bit of bipartisan support, even if we haven't been able to fix the problem, around things like military sexual trauma, harassment in the military, things that women and men have experienced in the military. And this, in a way, is just another chapter of that, which was mortifying. The idea that we would have hardworking female soldiers in the military right now and have a system that overlooks the harassment, the traumatization, the culture that hasn't completely changed. So this is one of several bills I've introduced. All of them generally are bipartisan. They're ways to make sure people get adequate counseling, that they're considered for benefits based on the experiences that they've had. Just ways to make sure we're recognizing this and considering it as we would any other kind of harassment on the outside if you're in the workplace and how it would be handled.
Are you optimistic that this is a discreet bill that you can get through?
You never know. And discreet bills are hard to get through these days, but often the language gets changed. And frankly, again, we've had many, many meetings with the Pentagon, and this is members of the House, the Senate, both sides of the aisle, mostly women, to talk about these issues. And we've seen progress moving forward. We just haven't gotten to the finish line on so many of these issues. And this was, I think, something that mortified the Pentagon to discover that it was going, this particular thing was going on at the level it was.
You spent the day yesterday, I believe it was at an Island Institute forum on rural broadband.
We met at the Island Institute in Rockland, but it was really about rural broadband, not just on islands, although since I live on an island, I'm very familiar with some of the challenges our 14-year-round islands experience. But this issue of broadband generally, and I think you'll hear, you hear the whole delegation talking about it, but we really would like to see progress moving forward, particularly if the president does propose an infrastructure bill. I think my position is that broadband is an essential part of our infrastructure, just like electricity was when we were trying to, you know, move the country forward. And we had the Rural Electrification Association that really supported communities getting connected. Now, if you're not connected to the grid, if you don't have good speeds of your internet access, or you had no internet access at all, it's very difficult to run a business in rural communities, maybe to move your job to the place where you'd like to be living because you don't have the adequate speeds. And just to put it in perspective, Maine is 49th in the country in access and in speed. So many people know that they, you know, have some access to the internet, but it's basically back at dial-up speeds, where cities around the country are getting to, you know, phenomenally fast speeds because there's a fair amount of private interest in that. But I believe that the, you know, federal government has a role to play here. And if there's some investment to be made in an infrastructure bill that ramps up our spending, I just want to be very sure that Maine isn't overlooked. I mean, we're already 49th. Let's not get to 50 or 53rd. You know, it's scary what could happen out there. And, you know, I learned a lot from talking to several of the communities who have been working hard on this, a few that have gone ahead and started to, you know, lay the groundwork for getting their own high-speed internet access, the issues around the policy and the issues around the money. There's a lot to talk about, but it's a really important time to move forward for the Maine economy.
I want to ask you about the U.S. airstrikes on a Syrian airfield after the horrific footage of the, you know, apparent chemical weapons attack. What was your reaction when it happened? And as we move forward, what do you want from the president? I have read that you want him to seek congressional authorization for any further military action. Do you believe the original attack was appropriate?
Well, most likely he should have come to Congress before that attack. But I think many of us were horrified by those pictures, and that this isn't really the appropriate time to go back and argue about what he did, whether or not it was effective, whether he hit the right target. There are a lot of questions being asked. And we're going through a series of briefings right now. We had one earlier this morning about some of the background around that. But I think there's nearly universal support for the idea that the president should come before the Congress, that it's his constitutional duty to get an authorization for the use of military force. They're called AUMFs, and we have debated them for a long time. And I've also said that I want to hear the president talk about the refugee crisis. I mean, the Syrian refugee crisis and the international crisis around refugees is, you know, the greatest the world has ever seen since World War II, and maybe even worse than that. And it's hard for me to hear him saying, it's hard to hear the compassion he's showing around the beautiful babies who were horrifically killed and then be unwilling to let those same babies and families come into our country. In the two bans that he's proposed, both of which have been stayed by the courts, the first one in particular, he banned all Syrians from entering the country. and cut the quota in half. Now, just to be clear, the quota last year for Syrians entering our country as refugees was only 12,000. It just pales in comparison to what other Western nations are doing. And it just asks the questions, how can we call ourselves a compassionate nation if we're unwilling to take any of those families in? So I think that's a big concern. And I think also hearing from the president about what the strategy is going forward, if we're going to play a stronger role in Syria, that is the responsibility in Congress to have authority over that. And more importantly, it's through those kinds of debates and dialogues that the American public gets to make up their own minds about what our level of engagement will be and how we should go about doing it.
We're speaking with First District Representative Shelley Pingree. Shelley, do you have confidence that the House Intelligence Committee will do a good job investigating the apparent Russian connection and Russian meddling in the election?
Well, I think we're all very concerned, and I'm one of the members, like so many others, who called for an outside or an independent investigation. I worry with political pressure on Congress, and I think we saw some of that with Congressman Nunez, who's now recused himself from the investigation. But some of the action that he took, that clearly there was White House involvement in either encouraging him or assisting him in doing that, made many of us wonder, can he be an objective outsider? Now, I know that, again, there's great support on both sides of the aisle for doing a thorough investigation of understanding the Russians' involvement in our election. I don't think we can diminish how serious that was, and I don't think we can walk away from the questions about what were any possible contacts with the president or his campaign at that moment in time. They've reconstituted the House committee. The Senate committee seems to be fairly serious, so I am looking forward to seeing the information as it comes out as they move forward, but I will continue to be a supporter of an outside investigation.
Next year, you'll have served in Congress for 10 years. Have you considered if and what you will run for in 2018? Will you be running for Congress again? Will you run for governor?
Well, that's always a nice question, and I appreciate a lot of people have suggested to me, oh, you should run for governor, or have you ever thought of running for the United States Senate? Right now we have two very solid United States senators, and we have an open seat running for governor. So I'm certainly willing to give it some thought, but the truth is it's been an honor to serve in the House of Representatives. A lot of what we're able to do in the House has to do with time spent there, understanding how to be effective and building up seniority. So there's this frequent question of people who serve in public office. Oh, what are you going to run for next? You know, what's your next plan? And there's something to be said for doing a really good job at what you do and not always having your eyes set on the next job and the next opportunity. I've never said no, and I'd certainly consider it. But right now, I am happy to be a member of the House of Representatives. As difficult as these times are, I'm honored to represent the state of Maine. And I know that people look to all of us in the House to kind of bring some order to what feels like a very chaotic time, and I take that job really seriously.
When do you need to decide for sure by? What, do you have a deadline?
No. Honestly, I've just been pretty focused on this. I mean, I understand races like a race for governor or any changes that people make. Lots of people are thinking about it. Lots of good people are thinking about running, and pretty soon it will become evident to all of us what the field's going to look like.
All right. Well, if you'd like to ask a question of First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Support for Maine Calling comes from the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical, and Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, committed to offering eco-friendly furniture for living well in smaller spaces. CondoFurniture.com.
Practical advice for a local politician who has just taken the oath.
When you go to the grocery store, buy your frozen food last.
Okay.
Because people are going to stop you in the aisles and they're going to want to talk to you, and your food will melt.
I'm Audie Cornish, passing on the wisdom learned in the trenches of City Council this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. Maine Public is the media sponsor of Portland Ovation's classical series, including a performance by celebrated pianist Emmanuel Axe at Merrill Auditorium this Saturday afternoon. Mr. Axe returns to the Merrill stage for a performance of solo works by Schubert, Adams, and Chopin. Maine Public members are eligible for 10% off tickets. For details on this Saturday's event and how to take advantage of the Maine Public member discount, visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree with me to talk about the latest news from Washington. Shelley began her political career by serving on the school board and getting elected the local tax assessor, a job she says no one else in town wanted. She's now in her fifth term in the U.S. House of Representatives. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with a tweet. This is a tweet from Dan. How does Congress hold Trump accountable to ethics and financial conflict? Dems influence GOP? How?
That's a good question. And in Twitter speak, I think the second half means, can the Democrats influence the GOP, the Republicans? So it's a very good question. And I think there's been a lot of concern raised about both the fact that the president is unwilling to disclose his tax returns, so we don't know if there are conflicts of interest, and this current investigation that's going on about whether or not there was any contact between his campaign and the Russians in what clearly has been proven to be some Russian attempts to influence our elections. Now, not to get into a whole civics lesson, but the short version is, you know, we're co-equal branches of government. So Congress, in a sense, doesn't have, like, oversight on the president. We can't order him to do very much. People often ask me, like, what would it take to impeach the president if there was sufficient information? But there's a lot of territory to cover between now and then. And in the civics lessons part of it, the majority party holds most, if not all, of the cards about taking any action. So we've taken votes on the floor of the House, several of them, basically demanding or requesting the president to release his tax returns. Well, when we proposed one of those votes, then immediately the Republicans who are in the majority moved to table it. So we can't move it forward. We've had some privileged resolutions of inquiry that they will send to a committee to investigate it, but then they're able to not take a vote to move it out of committee and back onto the floor. So in a sense, the second part of the question is the critical one. Enough information has to be out there that raises enough concerns that are sufficient Republicans who are willing to go forward with an investigation, an inquiry, any of these things that we've suggested. And we're not going to stop suggesting them or stop attempting to do this because we just think it's very important for the for the health of our democracy, if nothing else, but also some of the questions that have been raised. But right now, Democrats have not been able to advance a vote because we don't have the majority. We just can't win the vote.
We'll go to Eastport and Virginia. Hi, Virginia. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a comment and a question. As far as the ACA health care, the thing is, why can't the Republicans and the Democrats, rather than repeal, because the Democrats will never go along with that as far as repeal. It's like when Medicare started, Social Security, repair. And okay, then my other question, Mrs. Pingree, remember when LePage wouldn't take the expansion plan here? Is it true or not that even if you didn't take those federal funds to go into Medicaid and all that, they still got the funds and they could also use it in their campaigns?
Wow, that's an interesting question, but absolutely not. There's no way Medicaid funds would come into the state and get used in a campaign. That money just doesn't cross that kind of a divide in any way. You're right in saying that Governor LePage refused. I think there have been 6 or 7 votes in the Maine State Legislature. He's vetoed them every time, and the legislature hasn't overturned them. Maybe it's 5 votes. That's been a huge economic loss to our state. I'm very frustrated and sad that our state didn't receive what might have been close to $500 million every year, which would have gone a long way to support many people through the Affordable Care Act. and frankly could have alleviated some of the problems that people have experienced trying to pay their costs of insurance. So I still hold out hope that every legislative session they will eventually agree to do that. One thing that's made it even more critical, not to get too wonky, but the Republicans in their plan have suggested block granting Medicaid. Well, we would be a little bit frozen in time if that were to happen, if they, for instance, took this year as the year, because since we're not accepting the Medicaid expansion funds, that's an enormous amount of money we don't currently receive that other states around the country do. So their numbers would be somewhat artificially higher than ours, even though we have this higher level of need, because we've never taken that money. So if that ever got frozen in time, and it was a time when we weren't accepting those funds, it would just do double the damage to our state. So I have kind of hoped the legislature would jump on board and say, well, at this moment in time, we better do it, because if they're going to be block granted, we don't want to be left behind. Remember, when you don't take those funds, it doesn't mean that you get a refund on your own taxes. It means that they go to some other state, you know, Kansas or Louisiana, or I don't know which states accept it, but it goes somewhere else. You know, the state of New York is getting the money that would have come to Maine, and it doesn't give you a tax refund. So, and to the part of your question about could Democrats and Republicans work together, I truly believe we could. You know, the challenge right now in Congress, it's sometimes hard to understand from the outside, isn't that there aren't plenty of Democrats kind of in the middle who would work with plenty of Democrats, I mean, plenty of Republicans in the middle, and that we see things very similarly. It's the Republicans against the Republicans. They have this problem within their own caucus, the group they call themselves the Freedom Caucus, who basically blocked moving forward on the vote. So that ACA repeal and the new proposals that they had, they couldn't get their Republicans to vote for it. That was their problem. And they still have this problem going forward. The extremely conservative members who just want to get rid of any health care reform at all and just, you know, kind of not have any government spending on anything, privatize Medicare, all kinds of things they'd like to do. They don't agree with the moderate Republicans. So we're happy to work with the moderates, but they have been unwilling so far to let us build a coalition together. And they control the votes on the floor. And right now we're just trying to encourage them to do the right thing.
Virginia, thanks for your question. Janet asks on Facebook, how likely do you think there will be a government shutdown due to the need for a continuing resolution by April 28th?
Well, I'm really nervous about that because April 28th seems like a long way off, but Congress is on a recess for 2 weeks right now. So unless they call us back early to debate a question around Syria or something else, we won't even come in until the week of the 28th. And we're basically in there 4 legislative days. At that moment, we have to pass another continuing resolution or some plan to fund the government for the rest of 2017, the year that we're already in, or the government automatically shuts down. Now, many of the political problems I've been talking about, Republicans being unable to agree with each other on these things, and some of the things the White House has proposed to put in this funding package have got a lot of people at odds. For instance, the White House would like to start allocating money to build a wall on the Mexican border. That's very controversial. It's a lot of money, maybe between $20 and $40 billion. And at this moment in time, it's not clear to anybody where we would get the money, particularly if the Republicans propose big tax cuts, if they want to do more defense spending. Like I said, there's no big picture plan. So it's hard for people to say, sure, we'll give you $6 billion now to start your wall, not even knowing where that money is going to come from in the future. So you can see there are a lot of things that are contentious right now, not only with Democrats, but many Republicans who don't agree with that money or want to see it paid for before we go ahead. So I would guess there'll be a fair amount of drama in that week. Maybe the Republicans will just push it forward and pass what's called a continuing resolution, basically punt for 3 weeks or 2 weeks or a month. But right now, we haven't seen anything to better understand what their plan is going forward.
An email from Karen. Will Congresswoman Pingree support the new version of last year's bill, H.R. 711, which will reform the Social Security system? This is being filed by Representative Kevin Brady and Representative Richard Neal. Will she support this bipartisan legislation, which would also repeal the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset? Mainers like myself are having their Social Security benefits reduced or even eliminated by these unfair laws. We need your help.
The short answer is yes.
Shortest Shortest answer of the day. We'll go to Susan, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And Congresswoman Pingree, I'd really like to thank you for supporting Planned Parenthood and women's health care. I'm worried about what can be done if the funding Planned Parenthood is linked in the budget bill. There's so many sideways attacks on women's health care, and I don't know where that goes, and I'm hoping that you have an answer for that.
Well, thank you for your question. I'm equally worried, and as you may recall, there have been other times when the government almost shut down over this question of funding Planned Parenthood. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just an awful thing to do. Planned Parenthood provides, in many cases, primary care services to a tremendous number of people in Maine, women and men. They're just a vitally important service that we have. And as we're looking at cuts in the Affordable Care Act, to think that we would lose that in our state and others across the nation makes absolutely no sense. So you can be confident that there are many of us who won't vote for any kind of a budget or a proposal that includes defunding Planned Parenthood. But again, the Republicans hold the majority. This may be one of those things that, we can't save in the House, but actually gets saved in the Senate by some Republicans who are more moderate on this question. But it's a critical question, and the work that they do has been grossly mischaracterized, and most people in the country support having Planned Parenthood available. It's just kind of a certain conservative group in the Republican Party on the House side who will hold the budget hostage for just that reason.
Susan, thanks for your call. We'll move to Waldo and Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I want to speak about and ask the Congresswoman about this attack by this government upon the sovereign country of Syria. The sovereign country. It has a legitimate president acknowledged by people all over the world. And I am a reader of not just the American press, and I watch the American news, but I read the press from everywhere. And I was particularly struck by the fact that at the meeting which Mr. Tillerson just attended, was at the G7, I believe, he tried to get them to enact new sanctions against Russia just on this point, because they say, the American government and the press in this country, lockstep, say that the Syrian government exploded this gas bomb. And there is no legitimate proof that that happened. I have heard...
Kathy, do you have a question for Representative Pingree?
I want to know if the Congresswoman will support an independent investigation into this charge by the American government that the Syrians exploded this weapon.
Okay, go ahead, Congresswoman Pingree.
Well, thank you for your question. I can tell that you have been doing a lot of reading and studying, and the questions that you're asking me are completely appropriate. I actually was on an hour-long call this morning with my caucus trying to better understand some of the legal questions here, and it's a fair question to ask, and it will be asked internationally about whether the United States had the right, whether we were protecting our own citizens, whether we were protecting people appropriately in Syria from genocide. There are very strict conventions around these kinds of things, and one of the reasons that everybody in Congress, well, I would just say majority of my colleagues have been asking for the president to come back and ask for this thing called an AUMF. It's to make sure that any further action is legally sanctioned by the Congress, but also that he makes the case, which requires the very investigation that you're talking about. We have to see proof. A lot of that happens in secure briefings, so it's not things you can, just sort of talk about on the radio, but we have to see all the information to know why he's taking the action, how he justifies the action, and in fact, a president cannot, he can't continue in the direction that he has without the authorization of Congress. That's the United States Constitution, and it's there for a very good reason. Only Congress can involve us in conflicts like this or declare war. Now, a lot of presidents, including President Obama, and I want you to know I've frequently signed on to letters suggesting that he needed a revised AUMF, as it's called, because he had been operating off of the same one that came after 9/11. And that was protecting the country from future terrorist attacks. It was fairly specific. It absolutely does not cover this president in going into a sovereign nation like Syria. So he does not have current coverage under the previous AUMF. And some of us argued even that President Obama operated outside of the lines. And the reason it's important is that we are co-equal branches of government, and the Constitution requires the Congress to move forward, not the president. And while there are times that maybe the president needs to respond quickly to some kind of an attack or a specific action, in the long run, he doesn't have that level of authority. And sometimes people will look at him and say, well, he's the commander-in-chief. He has to act to protect us. But that's why we have long and reasoned debates in our country about what we should do moving forward. And sometimes you'll hear the president say, well, I don't like to give away my military strategy before I've done it. And there's some understanding about why that would be an argument that you make, but that is not how our democracy works. This is about a transparent argument where the citizens in our country have a chance to understand what we're debating, understand what the strategy and the plan is, not every little detail, but of, you know, the diplomatic part about, you know, how much troops will we use, what's the specific time limit, what's the geographic boundaries of it, you know, things that people deserve to know before we get ourselves in another conflict, which could turn out to be yet another prolonged situation like Iraq or Afghanistan that cost us trillions of dollars and cost many American lives as well as civilian lives in those countries. So these are really serious questions, and we shouldn't let this particular president or any president trivialize it or make it seem like a simpler question than it is.
Kathy, thanks so much for your call. If you have a question for U.S. Representative Shelley Pingree, representing the 1st District, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the creation of an American demagogue. We talk with Jeff Gwynn, author of a new book about the cult leader Reverend Jim Jones, who in 1978 led about 900 of his followers to kill themselves by drinking cyanide-laced punch. Jones developed his following as an itinerant preacher, faith healer, and social activist. Join us.
Tune in tonight at 7 o'clock. And coming up in about 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, Speaking in Maine takes us next to the Goldfarb Center at Colby College in Waterville for the 2017 Cotter Debate. This year's topic is a conversation about American democracy. Again, that's coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation with Maine's 1st Congressional District Representative, Shelley Pingree. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Ted, who's calling from Unity. Hi, Ted. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with the Congresswoman. And I'm calling on behalf of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. And I really just want to say up front how thank you to the Congresswoman for her tremendous support of family farm agriculture in Maine and across the country. And Shelley, you've been a true leader in working to move us towards sustainability in food production. And in MOFCA, we see organic agriculture as a key part of that move. And we wonder how you see organic farming faring under the new administration and in the next farm bill.
Well, thank you, Ted. Thank you for all the work that MOFCA does. I have to say I'm really proud to come from the state that has Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners. It's been an important organization for such a long time, and I think it's played such a huge role in the demographics of our state. You know, we're one of the few states in the country where the average age of our farmer is going down or stabilizing. We have twice the number of women getting into farming of any other state in the country. And we're seeing new farms come under cultivation and older farms find reasons to be successful into the future. And that's just not happening everywhere. So I'm really proud of our state. I think it's been a great boom to our rural economy. It's a huge attraction for tourists who want to come to our state, and people want to move their families to live here. And maybe one of the most important things to me is it just provides really great stories and examples. When I go back to my committee meetings and with my fellow congresspeople to say, look, here's what's happening in a state that's had growing infrastructure and a fair amount of support, and this could be happening everywhere in the country. So we're just starting to consider the next farm bill in Congress. And, of course, we're dealing with the appropriations of the president's cuts, and they're two kind of separate issues, and we're working on them both. This administration has proposed some of the biggest cuts to agriculture of any department. It's between 21% and 29%, depending on how you look at it. That would be devastating to our state in every way you can think of. Lots of grants that support farmers and expanding the value-added products they can produce on the farm, putting up hoop houses to extend their seasons, helping beginning farmers get the access to capital that they need, helping dairy farmers deal with some of the sticky problems that are going on now. It would be awful. So I'm counting on some of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to fight back against this particular budget, because there's no rhyme or reason behind a president who was elected by courting much of rural America to slap rural America in the face and say, sorry, now that I'm here, I'm going to spend that money somewhere else and I'm not going to support the critical things. And we know how important that is and how tough it is to make a living on a farm. When it comes to organics, we've been longtime supporters and, again, really proud to come from a state that has some of the highest percentages of organic growers in the country, and where farmers like dairy farmers have found new markets by selling into organic companies. And it's made a big difference for us. It usually means that it's a premium price for the person growing it, and it's also good for the environment, because keeping that organic material in the soil sequesters carbon. It does a lot of things that we need to have happen in it, and it also is better for the health of the farmer and the health of the farm. I'm sponsoring a bill on increasing the amount of organic research. We did some analysis a couple years ago and found out that at the USDA, the amount of money that was being devoted to organic research was less than 1% of the entire USDA budget, yet organics today make up about 13% of sales, and it's a very fast-growing industry, about $40 billion a year today in organic products. And what's happening, because there hasn't been sufficient support at the USDA, is increasingly people are going to foreign markets for some of those commodities like corn and soybeans, and we have a lot less confidence in the organic certification of them coming back that way. So we're pushing for organic research and organic transition money, and you know, some of the things that we consider really important, like making sure that there's soil in organics and that if there, you know, are different kinds of things considered under the organic label. It doesn't mean, you know, just not growing in a soil-free environment. So anyway, we've taken this all very seriously, and we've just been really lucky to have so many farmers who have been great examples and support from people like MAFCA and the University of Maine and other places where we've got really wonderful stuff going on. So I just can't say enough how important I think this is to the Maine economy. And I know we get kind of distracted with this administration by fires we are putting out and international issues, but in the long run, these are the things that are going to move a state like ours forward, and we can't lose track of it.
Ted, thanks so much for your call. We have a couple questions, Representative Pingree, about climate change. I'll choose this one. This is a Vagabond Coffee Car on Twitter asks, with 3,000 miles of coastline in Maine and rising ocean levels, how does Shelley work with climate deniers to protect the earth?
It's just shocking to me that there are even people who we can still call climate deniers. I mean, particularly coming from Maine, whereas the question mentioned, you know, we're already facing rising sea level, which has a huge impact on our working waterfronts and coastal communities, where it's getting more and more difficult to get insurance, to get a mortgage, to expand your property. And there's just a lot of uncertainty going forward, not to mention that the Gulf of Maine is warming at a rate 99.9% faster than any other ocean in the world, which is unthinkable, and has a lot to do with our proximity to the Gulf Stream and the melting of the polar ice cap and just the way the kind of currents happen. But this could have a horrendous impact on our fisheries, which are such an important economic part of our state. They're an important cultural part of our state. They're critical to the livelihoods of our coast. Ocean acidification, the changing nature of the ocean, is critical. I've sponsored bills on all topics, and many of them, like ocean acidification and working waterfronts, I have bipartisan support. But the fact that this administration has called climate change a hoax, that has gone out of its way in the early days of the administration to try to flush information and scientific research off of websites of the executive branch, things that have been, you know, peer-reviewed science, great work that's been done at NOAA, at the United States Department of Agriculture, just, you know, across the board. We're not even allowed to use the term climate change. And it just has so many impacts on our lives, particularly here in Maine. Tick outbreaks, you know, which have been driven because of our changing climate. Just one thing after another. So I'm mortified by the current state that we're in. I'm extremely angry at an administration who thinks that we can turn our head the other way. This is, again, there's plenty of bipartisan support that we have to deal with this issue. If we don't, it's just a crime against our children and grandchildren and the people who will, you know, come after us. They're going to turn around and say, you know, what were you doing when you let this beautiful planet fall apart? So we have our work cut out for us, and I just think we have to work at it every day.
We're going to move on to Jerry, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon. First off, thanks, Jennifer, and your team for doing this for the people of Maine. It's appreciated. For Congresswoman Pingree, I want to thank you for your position and your perspective on the Department of Defense budgets. Just a quick comment and then a quick question, I think. So you are all going back to Washington and be voting on the budget in like 3 weeks. And the DOD requests for this coming year are pretty huge. What do you think is the realistic perspective of getting an audit of the Department of Defense? We've been asking for it for years and years, but you need to be informed about votes you're going to take in Washington. How realistic is it that we're going to see an audit of the Department of Defense?
Yeah, thanks for your question. As you know, the defense budget is usually the largest amount of discretionary funding that the Congress looks towards, and this president is very likely to ask for steep increases in the Department of Defense. I would like to see, a democratic negotiation around that coupled with an audit of the Department of Defense. Obviously, we need to keep our country safe, and there are strategic ways where we have to enhance our readiness for some of the challenges that are out there. All that said, we spent an enormous amount of money in the last two wars. Conflicts in the future are going to look very different than the ground wars that we've been in. And we have to know what the strategy of the Pentagon and this administration is going forward. And we can't just see them throw money at it based on kind of vague threats or suggestions that they're going to be the administration that makes this country safer. It, as you correctly mentioned, is a very difficult issue to tackle because frequently people worry that if we cut defense spending, somehow we will be endangering our future. Yet, on the other hand, we know that we just have to be smarter about this, that it can't be this big cavern that you open up and pour money into it. And I think, whether the president chose to conduct the actions that he did recently because he knew it would improve his polling or because he was taking on a compassionate act in a country that we're very worried about. The fact is, when we go to war, it enhances a president's approval. And when we go to war, we spend an awful lot of money and lose lives. And we need to learn from the last two conflicts that this has to be very carefully thought through. And any enhancement of the actions taken by this country will come with dramatically increased spending. And that spending has to be closely audited because it's easy when you open the floodgates to just see it pouring through. And I observed that in my first couple of years of Congress. No one wanted to cut defense. And now is an important time to think about it carefully.
Jerry, thanks for your call. We'll move to Westbrook and Joanne. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you, Jennifer and NPR, for sponsoring Representative Pingree. And Representative Pingree, thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for all that you're doing for us in the Congress. I'm concerned about a lot of things, but what's on my mind right now is the military action that we've taken in Syria without approval of the Congress. Congress is now on break, and from what I understand, the president is sending warships to the Korean Peninsula to do military exercises with the South Koreans, which has irritated the North Korean president. So it looks like we're setting ourselves up for confrontation with North Korea and possibly more action in Syria without any congressional oversight or approval. I'm really concerned about that. What can we do about that, or what can Congress do about that?
Thank you for your question, and I share your concerns, and I worry, again, that this president, having taken one action, is feeling very empowered to continue to move forward. So as I mentioned earlier, he is not constitutionally allowed to enhance the activities in Syria without the approval of Congress. Now, he may try to go ahead with it anyway, but I think it's critical that the Congress remains very vigilant in demanding that he call us back, or that we have a debate as soon as possible. Now, my leadership in the Democratic Party has said it's the president should bring us back. We're on a 2-week recess at a time when, very questionable things are happening around the globe, and he's making very strong statements. Well, before he takes any action, while we're out of town, the Republican leadership should bring us back into Congress, and we should go ahead and debate the president's actions. He has no authority to be taking action in Syria, and we need a lot more investigation about what's going on and what happened as a result of this attack and the original chemical weapon attack, what was behind that, and what do we know about it. Secondly, in North Korea, the president has recently said after his meeting with China, now he said this to Congress based on a Twitter post, and I just want to be clear, I don't think that we should have our chief executive communicating with us via Twitter, but we often learn things that way. And he said, well, you know, if China is unwilling to fix the problem, then we will. Well, that's a very vague kind of threat. It's not clear. We've been hearing some of the same things that you mentioned, that there's a military activity going on, readiness, preparedness going on in places around the country. And it's just critically important that the president cannot move ahead without a strategy, without a clear picture of what we're getting ourselves into, and without the support of the Congress and the American people. And I'm just as worried as everybody else that he's making motions to go ahead and do that. And we'll do everything I can to make sure we're engaged in that conversation.
Joanne, thank you for your question. And that is going to be our last question of the hour. Congresswoman Pingree, thank you so much for joining us today. Shelley Pingree was first elected to represent Maine's 1st Congressional District in 2008. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Sam Dearin answered the phones. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.net. Today's show will rebroadcast tonight. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about teaching adulting skills. There are schools offering instructions in basic life teaching skills, from managing personal finances to cooking and cleaning. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.